Hello, it's Friday, 15th of March. I'm Hannah Pearson. On today's show, Gary Bowen and I will rewind through the region's top travel and tourism talking points from the first quarter of 2024. So let's get started. This is the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Hello, wherever you are in the world, and thanks for listening in. So, as we near the end of Q1 of 2024, we also move towards another regional milestone. As you probably remember, because we've been talking about it for so long, the 1st of April 2022, 2 years ago, was when Southeast Asia began to fully reopen after those long, dark days of the pandemic. So, 2 years later, how has the first quarter of 2024 panned out? And what have been some of the key takeaways? Hannah and I have drafted a list of our top eight travel and tourism talking points from around the region, which generally I would say is quite aviation heavy. I think that just reflects where the industry is right now. So Hannah, where should we kick off?
Well, let's start with the festivals, right? And of course, you know, for us in Southeast Asia, the nice thing is once Christmas is over, you know, that's not the end of the festival season. We're just starting to get started here, aren't we? So, you know, the Chinese New Year decorations go up pretty much as soon as the Christmas decorations go down. And the timings this year, it all just carries on. So we've got Lunar New Year, then it's followed by Eid coming up on the 10th of April, followed by Songkran on the 13th to 15th of April. And of course, that, you know, Songkran is celebrated in different ways in Cambodia and Laos too. So everybody's got a festival and everybody's traveling.
Yeah, exactly. And although, you know, this really goes back to what I said in the intro, doesn't it, Hannah? It's 2 years since Southeast Asia began to open in April 2022. So we didn't really get a lot of those festivals in 2022. 2023, Southeast Asia had been open for a year. Most of Northeast Asia had only been open for a few months. China really had only just started, and there wasn't much flight capacity. So really, 2024 is the first year that we've had this full festive season. That's reflected, I think, in the coverage of travel and tourism, in the response of destinations, and the reporting of statistics, which just seems to be every day you get new statistics at the moment. But, you know, there's that sense that 2024 is this year where, I hate to use the word because it's not really real, but there is a degree of normalization in the way people are traveling once again.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right about numbers. I mean, I've got numbers coming out of my ears that I've written down, you know, 2.3 million people were crossing between the Singapore-Malaysia border over Chinese New Year. 100,000 Chinese came into 100,000 Chinese came into Malaysia. 10,000 Malaysians went to South Thailand. What else have we got? 872,000 international arrivals into Thailand in general. And when you start talking about Eid, those, you know, 1 million numbers, they go up hugely. So right now, Indonesia's anticipating 194 million Indonesians will travel over the Eid period, so between 3rd to 21st of April, which is about 72% of the total population, and up significantly from last year. Like you said, Gary, you know, this is this full year, in a way, perhaps, of that domestic travel. So, and just travel in general over these festive periods. So last year was 123.8 million. So from that to 194 million is quite a jump. Even you're looking at Garuda, Indonesia. The group are offering 1.4 million seats over that period as well. So we're talking big, big numbers.
Yeah, that's really true. You're starting to, I mean, I guess you're the same, Hannah, but my email inbox, my WhatsApp, you know, it's just full of travel promotions at the moment in a way that it hasn't been actually for many years. I don't think I got as many as this in 2018, 2019. It's there's a real sense that there's a real push to promote visitor numbers over the next few months. And I think there is a focus at the moment on this festive travel seasons, the micro analysis of every statistic that comes up. But I think we're only really going to get an accurate position of where 2024 is, probably at the halfway point of the year, at the end of June, but most certainly at the end of the year. You know, we know that season travel is very, very seasonal, and we'll see, you know, some peaks and troughs across the year, just as we used to. That's going to be a degree of normalization. But that element of statistics and meeting targets, Hannah, is something we know that 2024 is going to be all about. Who and who isn't matching 2019 levels? And our second item on our list is an airport that has, or temporarily has, as I said, we have to be careful on the micro analysis. But Changi Airport, Hannah, tell us a bit more.
So Changi Airport, I think we can say it is the first airport in Southeast Asia to surpass its 2019 international seat capacity numbers. So they carried 5.3 million passengers in February 2024, which is actually 4% higher than 2019. So someone's done it. They've gone past it. You know, it's up 33.7% year on year. But I mean, as we always say with Singapore, you always have to caveat it with the fact that it is very different to the rest of Southeast Asia in the fact that it only has international departures and arrivals. It doesn't have any domestic market. So if you were looking at total seat capacity for domestic market, I mean, Vietnam surpassed that already, I think, back in 2020 or 2021. But what is really helping Changi's recovery is, of course, that air capacity, which has been restored to China. So in February, the news reported that that was back over 2019 levels. If you're looking at March, it's about 99% back. When you compare that to some of the other Southeast Asian countries, they are miles and miles ahead. So if you're looking just in general at seat capacity in March for Southeast Asia, Singapore is up there, minus 4%. So that's interesting. So February was higher. I think we're going to see March coming in maybe about 2019 levels, a little bit lower once they report the full passenger numbers. So we're talking seat capacity versus passenger numbers. But Philippines actually is not doing too badly. If you have their total seat capacity in March, they're only minus 1% off 2019 levels, which surprised me because you don't see as much of a fanfare around air travel in the Philippines.
Yeah, that's true. And also, we're going to have to be aware of this, I think, through the year. There is a degree of statistical trickery as well. If you look at the February statistics for Changi Airport, yeah, it's correct. You know, it more than meets 2019 capacity, but off a fairly low base. And also remember, February 2024, we had an extra day. It's a leap year. So, you know, that does add capacity. Adding to that, if you look at February this year versus January, actually, there was more seat capacity in January than there was in February. But February, obviously, you're comparing month on month back to 2019. So this is one of the things that we're going to see throughout the year is these peak months, these trough months, and how, you know, it's really only going to be a full year's data that's actually going to enable us to judge compared to 2019. Month on month, yeah, it's going to vary.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great point. And especially when you look at January and February and you've got the whole variable of where does the Lunar New Year fall as well, because, of course, that moves around too. And that impacts everything as well. So, yeah, it's up, it's down. Probably be back down again in March. Let's see where we go in April. But it's definitely a positive sign anyhow. I think we can take it, whether it's slightly up or slightly down. The fact that we are getting there, really, really gives hope, I think, to the tourism industry at large in Southeast Asia.
Yeah, let's take the positive. So number three, now this relates to ITB Berlin. Hannah, you were there, and so too was the Thai Prime Minister, and he was selling tourism, which is pretty unusual to see a Prime Minister at ITB Berlin. Can you fill us in a little bit more about what he said and what he didn't say?
Yeah, exactly. So, yep, I was at ITB Berlin last week for the Adventure Travel Trade Association there with my adventure travel hat on, and somehow managed to get invited to this networking event with the Thai Prime Minister. The ATTA was, I think we're just on the right mailing list at the right time. So, of course, I had to go. I had to go see him. And the things that he was saying were not surprising. And perhaps that's because you and I, Gary, we follow this kind of thing very closely. So for me, he was not really saying anything groundbreaking. The same kind of things. We're going to focus on soft power. We've waived visas. We want to build up Thailand as an aviation hub. We're investing in airport infrastructure. We're doing this amazing tour where they're bringing these airport executives around secondary cities of Thailand to try to convince them to start operating international flights into those. One thing that he did mention that I thought was interesting that he was stressing again was this idea, Gary, that we discussed, I think, on the on the maybe it was the January roundup, this idea of this almost Schengen-like agreement between Southeast Asian countries, where if you had a visa for one, you'd have a visa for all. So that was in there, which I was surprised at, because I thought, oh, actually, maybe he is taking this idea quite seriously. You know, maybe that's being really pushed forward. What he didn't mention, and what I thought was super interesting that he didn't mention, was sustainability. There was not a single mention of any of the campaigns that Thailand is doing around sustainability or being green or their circular economy, as they call it, because we have seen a lot of news and press from TAT highlighting these kind of initiatives. So, for example, the Thai Ecotourism and Adventure Travel Association, ATTA signed an MOU with them last week. They are promoting all of these zero carbon tours, which is also being supported by TAT. And when you add that to the fact that in Europe itself, ITB Berlin is the place to meet the world, yes, but also Europe in general, European buyers. The focus is so keen on sustainability right now. You know, that's that for me, I've just found it so strange that he didn't mention it and was just instead just mentioning these big targets, big aviation hubs, and the sustainability, and it didn't get a look in.
Yeah, that's fascinating. That's a great wrap up. It's interesting that, you know, the Thai Prime Minister only came into power last year after the delayed and quite controversial election. You know, he's been traveling the world trying to sell Thailand. I think it's 14 countries that he's been to so far. He was in Germany, obviously, last week, been to Davos, been to ITB Asia. And he's currently on the front of Time magazine this week, where they're calling him, the headline calls him the salesman, because he's basically trying to sell Thailand, to sell trade and foreign direct investment, which goes back to our interview with Vincent Vadakkan, which I think was that earlier this year, where he said exactly the same. You know, this soft power elements that the Prime Minister wants to promote about Thailand isn't just about tourism. Tourism is a big part of it, but it's basically selling the country as a destination for investment as well as travelers. And because, as the article in Time this week says, the Prime Minister says that Thailand is still in an economic crisis and it's trying to find its way out, and tourism is going to be front and center of doing that.
Yeah, I found that really interesting as well, that he was on the front cover. And I wondered how many other Southeast Asian prime ministers have made it to the front cover of Time magazine recently, or for perhaps the right reasons rather than sometimes the more infamous reasons that Southeast Asia gets in the spotlight when it comes to politicians.
Yeah, the only one I could think of is Jokowi, probably.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, he would be there. It's kind of fascinating. He's really on this sales mission. You know, he seems to have been making progress, at least with if you're looking at the Schengen visa requirement that Thais have to go through to enter Europe. It seems now that he has Macron's support to try to get that waived. And if he did, that would be a massive deal for Thailand. I can imagine that would ease, of course, not only tourism, but, you know, just business between the two countries as well. And you know, forge Europe and Thailand closer together. So he's playing a clever game, I think, Shweta.
Yeah, let's see what happens. Watch this space. So as we're rounding up the top talking points from travel and tourism in Southeast Asia in the first quarter of 2024, the biggest media story has been and continues to be, although she has actually now left the region, is Taylor Swift and her 6 shows in Singapore, which generated probably more media print than any other story in travel and tourism, maybe in the last decade, would you say, Hannah?
Yeah, it's been massive, hasn't it? And, you know, I feel a bit jaded. I was like, should we even include Taylor Swift in this Q1 roundup? Like, people are going to be tired of hearing it about her again. But we have to, right? Because it was such an epic story. And I think what's interesting is that it developed into this whole political story as well, didn't it? Over the last few weeks, that's gone beyond what's that tourism impact. But it started with the Thai Prime Minister almost complaining or lamenting, I saw as a word, which is, I think that's the word they used in one of the articles, which I think is good, about how if only he'd known that Singapore had paid, allegedly paid, money to gain exclusivity rights for Southeast Asia, then he would have done the same. And this kickstarted a whole chain, didn't it, of rhetoric from different countries, from finger pointing, from, you know, ending up with Singapore having to kind of not come clean, but having to say, okay, well, yes, we did negotiate these rights. And Philippines chair of the House Committee on Ways and Means was requesting that a note verbal would be sent to the Singaporean embassy to explain this allegedly exclusivity deal and all of this. But Singapore just got in there. And from what it seems, there was quite an interesting interview with Kallang Alive Sport Management and the Straits Times. And they were just saying, look, we just saw that opportunity. We started proactively reaching out to Taylor Swift even before that international tour was announced. And then they went for it. Basically, the whole government worked together. Yes, they gave some kind of grants. They've still not said exactly how much, but they've said it is not as much as being rumored. And they secured it.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think, you know, the issue is that it was a proof of concept in many ways. You know, as Taylor Swift has toured Southeast Asia before, it's not the first time, but she wasn't the same megastar that she is now. And I think it's just proved that Singapore was so right to get in ahead and do that. It's a business decision. They've reaped a lot of media. They've reaped a lot of destination branding, and they've cashed in. They made a lot of money out of it, which is a great idea. And, you know, anybody else claiming that they should have known about that, well, you had the same opportunity, so, and you missed them. But I think what this has done is it moves now beyond Taylor Swift, and it now looks at how the region will actually develop concert tourism as a really, really central part of travel and tourism promotion in future. I think in that sense, Taylor Swift has been pretty transformative, as she has been in the US as well, and as she will be as the tour goes around the world. You know, she is the preeminent global megastar at the moment. But, you know, the legacy over the next 5 years will be that you will see intense competition between destinations in Southeast Asia and in the wider APAC region to attract and to gain exclusivity when the big stars are touring. So let's move on, Hannah. That's four we've got in the bag. Number five is quite an interesting story. It goes back to aviation, and this is the Chinese C919 jet, which debuted at the Singapore Air Show back in February and is also doing five different showcases at airports throughout Southeast Asia. Now, I think this is a pretty interesting story for a number of reasons. I think, you know, it's being promoted as China's real move to become a major seller and distributor of aviation aircraft and to challenge the duopoly of Airbus and Boeing. Lot of reasons why it's doing this. One of them, I think, primarily is just the size of the domestic aviation market in China, which is, I think, slated to become the world's largest domestic aviation market over the next few years. And it's needing a lot of new planes, and it wants those to be manufactured and produced by Chinese companies. COMAC is a state-owned company. Then the element is, well, can it start selling these internationally? That's where it gets a bit more difficult, of course, because although the C919, which is it's a narrow body jet, I think it can handle up to about 200 passengers, and it can travel up to about 5,500 kilometers. So it's a broad range jet. But although it's actually certified by the Civil Aviation Administration of China, I think that's almost 2 years ago now, September 2022, it's not yet certified by any of the international in Europe or in the US or even here in Southeast Asia. So there's going to be a lot of marketing and a lot of, you would think, diplomatic moves to try and get aviation administrations in Southeast Asia to verify it. I guess we'll have to watch that space. But it was obviously very symbolic that it chose the Singapore Air Show as its international debut.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and I wouldn't be surprised, I think, to see approvals coming in Southeast Asia rather than in other parts of the world. First, like you say, it's just all part of that diplomacy kind of package. And, you know, if you're looking at Europe, I mean, they said, you know, they're going to take time to approve it, of course. And I think particularly in light of all of the issues that are going on with Boeing at the moment, I can imagine that that's making aviation authorities extremely careful to approve new models and completely new manufacturers.
Yeah, I would agree. So sticking with aviation, Hannah, we'll move from Singapore up the Malay Peninsula to Malaysia. And the Malaysian Aviation Commission has just announced new passenger service fees, which come into force on the 1st of January and run for a 2.5 year period through December 2026. They involve a kind of restructure in the way that passenger service fees, which you pay in your air ticket, are actually assessed and paid for, but big hikes as well, aren't they, Hannah?
They are, if you look in terms of, particularly where that the bracket where this is impacted a lot is travel to ASEAN countries. So domestic is not so much impacted. It is more ASEAN out of KLIA 1, which is where the main mainline airlines tend to fly out from, rather than KLIA 2. If you're looking at an increase from 35 ringgit to 73 ringgit. But if you're looking at it in actual terms, okay, 38 ringgit. To be honest, I don't feel like it's such a huge jump, especially in light of the fact that airfares just in general are more expensive anyhow. What's 38 ringgit more compared to a flight that perhaps used to be 200 ringgit and is now 500 ringgit? So I think it's fair enough to do it. They haven't changed it up for a while. And you look at Thailand implemented increased passenger service charges last year as well. Malaysia's talking a lot about how they need to improve airport infrastructure. And we've seen that, right? Some of the Malaysian airports are regularly voted as some of the, let's say, least favorite airports to travel through in the world. Kota Kinabalu Airport's constantly getting complaints. Penang Airport, they want to expand. So they need to find the cash also to support some of this expansion.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the key point there, as you said, Hannah, is previously the passenger service charge was on different rates for ASEAN countries to non-ASEAN countries, and that's been abolished now, and they've been brought together under one increased fee. As you said, other countries are doing this. Malaysia isn't alone, although that's not necessarily a reason for doing it. Although having said that, I agree with you that the airport infrastructure in this country does need significant upgrades, which is recognized, I think, at the highest levels as well. But I guess what this really shows, Hannah, is this general trend that we've definitely seen throughout the region and beyond the region, actually worldwide, of passing off costs onto travelers increasingly, whether that comes down to entry fees to countries, visa rights, that kind of thing, airport passenger service, hotel fees, accommodation fees, those kind of things. It is becoming generally more expensive to travel because of these ancillary charges, in addition to what you're used to paying in terms of your flight, your hotel, your own travel costs. These extra costs are increasing, aren't they?
Absolutely. And to add to that, even Singapore's proposed SAF fee, which will be given to consumers. So yeah, it is getting increasingly expensive, and there's no real feeling that things are going to decrease yet. Of course, that feeds into there's been a lot of headlines recently, particularly around this festive travel with very high domestic airfares. And how do you resolve that? And can you resolve that? And how do you set ceiling fares? Or do you lower them? Do you raise them? And all of these other kind of issues that are ongoing really in the Southeast Asian aviation scene right now.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's six down. We've got two more to go. Number seven, Hannah, this was one of your selections. And this kind of goes back to something we were talking about a couple of minutes ago. And that's about engine issues, which are plaguing Southeast Asian airlines. Tell us a bit more.
Yeah, I mean, this is a fairly short story, but just one that keeps rumbling on, which is, of course, all of these Pratt & Whitney engine issues, which are not only affecting Southeast Asian airlines, but worldwide. But they are still having an impact in Southeast Asia and on certain airlines being able to restore their capacity. So, for example, Cebu Pacific was pretty badly hit actually by these kind of engine issues. They've had to really hold a lot of their flights. If you remember last year, they were running into a lot of issues, I think, where they basically had to pull a bunch of routes because they weren't able to deliver, and they were getting delays, they were last minute cancellations, and they were really put under pressure by the Philippine government to sort stuff out. So, they're saying that they're probably not going to add on any new markets to new destinations because they're still waiting for their A320neo aircraft to have all of these engine issues resolved. If you look at Vietnam Airlines, it's the same. It's their A320 Neo aircraft. They've had to ground 12 of their planes, which is about 20% of their domestic fleet, for maintenance because of this, and because of the supply chain disruption as well. So these two issues are really kind of impacting airlines' capacity to add back more routes, to add back higher frequencies, because they still don't have the planes.
Yep. And you know, that's an interesting point, isn't it? As we said at the top of the show, Hannah, we're 2 years into reopening. If we go back 2 years, we'll be expecting to be in this situation right now. Now, some people have said no, but then anybody else who was looking more rationally would have said yes. You can't really shut down travel ecosystems for 2 years and expect them to automatically come back. It's taken a lot of time, both on the demand side and the supply side. And we're still seeing that. And we'll still see that through 2024, Hannah. That's something we've both been saying, I guess, ad nauseum, even going back to the pandemic day. So let's finish up our list of the top eight travel takeaways from the first quarter of 2024. And this is an interesting one, Hannah, because this is an enduring story, really. And that's Air Asia pressing the PR trigger. Been at it again. What's it been saying this time?
Yeah, this time it has said that it's looking to start subsidiaries in Singapore and Vietnam. Now, Vietnam is quite interesting because I'd read that they've actually tried four times previously to establish a JV in the Vietnam market, but failed. And yet they've got their sights on Singapore and Vietnam again. What's kind of interesting, and we discussed this a bit yesterday, Gary, is the fact that they'd really talked about Air Asia Cambodia, if you remember, at the end of last year. And that's meant to launch this year. And I realize I've not heard anything more. Have you?
No, I haven't. This is so classic Tony Fernandez, really, that they press the PR trigger, they push out all of these messages, you know, and they promise. And, you know, you see so many media outlets saying they've got an exclusive interview with Tony Fernandez and he's given exclusive interviews to, you know, everyone around the world. But what they've done this time is quite interesting because, as you say, they're looking to open up new airline subsidiaries in addition to the ones that it already has here in ASEAN. But this is really in the context of Capital A, which is the overarching brand which has been set up to own and to operate the Air Asia licenses. The desire to actually list on the NASDAQ later this year, Tony Fernandez announced that around about the same time that you started to see this announcements about Singapore and Vietnam airlines being set up. The idea is to launch on the NASDAQ in alliance with a company called Ethereum Acquisition Corp, which is a special purpose acquisition company, a SPAC, which would, you know, enable Capital A to raise a lot of money. And the interesting thing that I've seen about this, Hannah, this isn't really a new story. It's been bubbling under for quite a while. We know that Air Asia and Capital A had all those problems. And, you know, this is really its chance to raise a lot of money and to expand the brand into probably new areas. The Capital A, I think, as it currently stands, in addition to the Air Asia brand, it owns the intellectual property rights for 14 other brands and apparently 224 trademarks as well. But I've noticed, if you go back to whenever it was, Tony Fernandez has always used the term ASEAN. Every interview he does, he always focuses on ASEAN and the potential of ASEAN markets. But if you look now at the way Capital A is branding itself, its new brand is called Uniting ASEAN and Beyond. And this is about going global. This is about actually raising more money and extending his ASEAN brands into global markets. Whether it's possible, whether he can pull it off, let's wait and see. But that's certainly the PR messaging as it is right now. And you would say, as you're leading up to a listing on an international bourse like the NASDAQ, that's exactly what he'll be advised to do. He said that they want to get listed by June or July, which is quite soon. But I guess we just have to watch this space. But I think that's the context for launching these new airlines.
Yeah, that's a great reading into it, I think. Yeah, they are great at press, AirAsia. What more can we say? But yes, if they did set up these subsidiaries, if they do start AirAsia Cambodia, great. But again, we've seen how difficult it is to get those kind of operations in place. And you've got to get everything lined up. I mean, AirAsia have got experience in it, but there's new markets, isn't it? Let's see.
And I think that's a great place to wrap up our top eight talking points for the first quarter of 2024, because this is one that will roll on and on and on. And it's a story that, you know, came to the fore during this quarter, but it's something we'll definitely be watching and talking about for the rest of this year and probably a long way into the future.
I'm sure. So with that, that brings the show to a close for this week. We hope you enjoyed the podcast, and please don't forget to send us your thoughts and comments on anything we discussed or anything we missed out. You can drop us a message on our LinkedIn page at the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Yep, and as always, you can catch up with the Southeast Asia Travel Show's full back catalogue on our website, the seasiatravelshow.com, and you can find us on any international podcast platform.
So that's a wrap for today, but we'll be back soon to talk more Southeast Asia travel and tourism with you then.